Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. Today we'll be talking to Edgar Garbolato about his story, A 14-Hour Lesson in Theosophy, which appeared in issue 20 of The Common in a portfolio of writing from the Lusosphere. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Edgar Garbolato is a writer and translator born in Brazil and based in the U.S. for 20 years. His translation of João Gilberto Knowles's novel Lord won the 2020 Djibouti Prize as Best Brazilian Book Published Abroad and was a finalist for the 2020 Lambda Literary Award in Best Gay Fiction. His translation of Knowles's novel Armada was published by Two Lines Press in November 2020, and Hugs and Cuddles, another award-winning novel by Knowles, is forthcoming from the same publisher in fall 2022. He has received fellowships from the Disquiet International Literary Program in Lisbon and the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, among others. He holds an MFA in creative writing from the University of Illinois and lives in Chicago, where he is currently editing his debut novel, Terra Incognita, written in both Portuguese and English. Edgar Garbolato, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Would you set the scene for our conversation and tell us where you're calling from?
Yes, I'm calling from Chicago, my home. I am actually sitting in my office / sunroom. So I'm looking out to the street and to the trees. It's an unusual warm day here in Chicago. We are in the 60s, despite still being winter.
Wow.
So it's a lovely weather for a great city that I love.
Yeah, that sounds great. We've got a little warm weather here as well in New England, and it's so nice.
It is nice.
Yeah. Would you start off with a reading from your story? Read maybe the first few paragraphs for us?
Yeah, of course.
Thanks.
A 14-hour lesson in theosophy, imagining the last hours of Clarice Lispector. 1:05 a.m., the rain starts. I arrive, so close to her, I can breathe the rain mixed with the sour smell of her scalp. 1:13 a.m. Fighting against the slowdown of the pills, C sits in front of the dressing table and hates what she sees. An ancient face with new furrows. An aged reflection of whom she thought she still was. A worsened version of herself. She can't leave the house tomorrow as she is now. Swollen face, short eyelashes, brittle hair stuck to her scalp. Gray spots mark her pale forehead, like stains on the face of a full moon, a reminder of the fire in the apartment that almost extinguished her years before. What she knows is that she needs to look well tomorrow. This will be her final spectacle, now that her relative success as a writer exposes her to eyes on the streets. After 13 books, she has become the subject of her own fiction, and the public expects her to be the actress of herself. If this small success had arrived 20, 30 years ago, maybe she wouldn't even care about her appearance, trusting people would hold on to her erstwhile image. But all that recent attention deprived her of the freedom of not being beautiful anymore, right at the moment of fleeing the scene. Maybe I'll stop there.
Perfect. Thank you so much for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your story yet, would you just briefly describe what the piece is about, sort of its general premise?
Yeah, so the piece is about a Brazilian woman, 57 years old, who lives in Rio. She's a writer. And she has published 13 books, and she never accomplished commercial success, but she has reached some small fame, especially within the literary circles. But unfortunately, that fame arrived too late. She's diagnosed with cancer, and she knows she has her time to live is very short. So, of course, the story, as I said in the beginning, is based on the life of a Clarice Lispector, or let's say the last days of Clarice Lispector's life. But it's an imagination, right? So this is fiction. It's not biographical. It was never my intention to write her biography because that has been done in different venues. My idea as a fiction writer was to put myself into ahead of someone on that situation. Again, 57 years old, living in Rio in the 70s, in finding herself in a position of relative success, but knowing that all that was came too late, that she was about to die. So there was, if we can call it plot, that would be the plot of the story. But I also think that the piece can be understood as somebody, a writer or a narrator, trying to imagine what it would be like to be in the head of someone who that person has read for his entire life. So it's a piece about this woman, yes, but it's also about collective subconsciousness of readers who live through writers' books. Am I making any sense?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's very meta, isn't it? That's sort of like you, the writer, but also the reader imagining the writer imagining her readers.
Yeah, exactly. It is. Yeah. And especially for Clarice Lispector, who was somebody who investigated the human mind, right? Yeah. I wanted to play with that component. Okay, now it's my turn to be in her mind. Of course, with a lot of liberty, right? I'm taking a lot of liberty here, and that's why I say it's not biographical. I could not guess what was in her mind, but I could imagine based on the life that she lived and the things that she wrote.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the idea. You know, I think as readers, it's so, you know, when you read something that's really compelling to you, especially if you read many works by the same author, like you just want to commune with them and you know, either they're out of reach or in this case, they've already passed away. And I love that you found a way to sort of commune with her in writing. I think that's great. So as an editor, it is always super exciting to see a piece like this in the submission queue because it's trying to do something unusual, which I think in this case is sort of both in terms of form and structure, because it's structured around these time stamps and these hours that we're passing. And then also in terms of topic, because you're imagining the inner life of a real person. And I think, you know, whenever you do something unusual, it's risky in a way in that, you know, writing choices like that can either pay off big or they can just turn the reader off or something like that. Would you tell us a little bit about the process of writing this and like choices that you made? And did you ever worry or have concerns that people would not be open to this style or this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I started answering your question from the last part. When I'm writing or jotting down the ideas, I'm not worried about what people are going to think. That comes later when I'm editing and discussing with other people as I discussed with you. Mm-hmm. I think giving a little bit of background how this story came to be, I started jotting down ideas. Every time I was reading Clarice Lispector or reading some biographical component of her life, and even watching her achieved success here in the West in the past 10 years, which was something that I never expected. Mm-hmm. So throughout this, let's say, past 10 years, watching that, observing that, and also, being inspired by her own reading and by her own life, I was jotting down ideas and writing different impressions of, this imagining of being inside her head, considering everything that was going on in her life at that point. So that was how the story came about. So it was not really a story to begin with. It was very much like a jotting down of ideas. And eventually, when I started to see something more tangible that could be published, I decided then to create a more, let's say, narrative guide, something that had a kind of a beginning, a middle, and an end. But it's still, when I submitted to the common, it was still in a rough form. And you actually, Emily, was the one who, first of all, it was great that you could see the potential in the piece, but you kind of gave me some ideas on how to give that shape of a narrative arc. So yeah, the style has pretty much been always the same, this kind of philosophical, sensorial way of looking at life and death and the city that she's in. The style was always there. The structure changed a lot based on feedback, and mostly from you, feedback from you. So again, it was great to see that you could relate to the piece. And then that's, I think, that's the best thing that a writer can ask for, is when he sees, okay, this resonated with someone, it can resonate with other people, let me work on this a little more.
I'm so thrilled to hear that. That's so great to hear. It was so long ago that we worked on the piece. In my memory, it was just perfect the minute it arrived. But I suppose you're right that we did do some revisions on it. I also am lucky in that we have a team of readers and interns who read things, and they give me their notes, and I think about which of their notes resonate with me and stuff. So it's never just me. But it's really interesting to hear that. Because I think you're right that it's a very philosophical piece. And, you know, she's remembering things and having inner thoughts and trying to put together things that have meaning for her, and not a lot of, you know, quote unquote action or plot or anything like that. And I think, you know, well, probably people are sick of editors talking to them about story arc all the time. But I think that I'm pretty sure that all we did was sort of rearrange things a little bit to make sure that it felt like there was an arc, because I think with a piece like this, you know, there would be no point in me as an editor going in and saying it needs more plot, it needs more action. Like, that's not what the piece is trying to do. And so I think, you know, as editors, we always try to like meet the piece with where it is and what it's trying to do. And, you know, either that resonates with you or it doesn't. And if it does, then you have to, you know, just sort of look at what small adjustments can be made rather than wishing it was a different style altogether or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also, I'm a writer who drives mainly, let's say when I write, I'm character driven. I'm not so concerned with plot, but I'm very concerned about investigating a character's mind. And that's what I was doing with this piece. I was not really concerned about plot. And if you think, you know, if you ask me what is the plot of the story, well, it's a woman taking a taxi to go to the hospice because she has cancer. That's the plot. But so that's not really my concern, let's say. My concern is going deeper, but there's also very in the character's mind, but also there's a very sensorial component in this piece that I really like too, and I think that's important, especially considering that it's Rio de Janeiro, and you have all that visual appeal happening outside the character's inner world. So it's a piece also about the communication between the inner world and the outer world.
Yeah, absolutely. That's perfect, because I was going to ask you about how you constructed Rio in this story, because I think it's so vivid and alive. And we sort of see it on a street level, and it's kind of dirty or crowded. Or there's traffic and there's people. And you know, Clarice has all these, you know, layers of memory of being around the city with her children and stuff like that. And then we also get sort of a zoomed out view that shows us like the high-rise buildings, but also the slums and the ocean and the smell of the ocean and that kind of thing. Would you talk a little bit about just capturing Rio and all those different ways that she experiences it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, Rio was a very important part of Clarice's life. She had lived abroad and for 20 years, but she always said that Rio was her place. And And you see that in all her work. A lot of her stories happen in Rio. And then I guess because I was also in a similar situation of living abroad for 20 years now, my relationship with Rio changed. When I was living in Brazil, I guess I didn't pay much attention to the city or what it represented. But then living in the United States makes me think about Brazil and Rio in particular in a more different way. So I kind of also have this aerial view of the city, like many people do. When people imagine Rio, they have this aerial photograph, right, of the mountains and the city and the ocean. I think when you talk about Rio, you kind of need that, those two perspectives, the aerial and also at the ground level. Aerial because it's simply a beautiful view. I mean, it's the backdrop is amazing with mountains and rocks and forests and cities. And then when you are down there on the ground level, you experience the city in a different way. Very busy and chaotic, and the presence of the ocean in all senses, on the smell and the quality of the air, everything is impacted so strongly by the Atlantic Ocean. So it was, yes, my impression of Rio, but again, trying to see through this character's eyes and try to feel the city through her, in a moment when she's departing life, which then unfolds a whole different set of emotions and feelings, right? So I, again, trying to imagine what is someone's farewell to the external world, this external world being Rio de Janeiro, a big city with all these components that I just described. It is, when I was explaining the beginning, it is a story about this woman, but it's also a story about Rio and the way the city can be experienced.
Yeah, that's what makes it such a great fit for the common. You know, we publish work with a strong sense of place. And I think, you know, for such an interior piece, there is a very strong place in your story. Absolutely. Now, I know from talking with you when we were working on revisions that this story has been through a lot of changes and revisions, even before I looked at it. I know you've workshopped it, and then you and I made some changes. And I was thinking about, I think that we, I don't remember what comment it was based on, but we added back a section that I think you had taken out earlier, which included a television interview that Clarice gave in the last weeks of her life. And Ben, I have since watched parts of this interview on, I think it's on YouTube. And I mean, you evoke it so vividly, and it's, you know, it's a hard watch, and it's a difficult section of the piece, but I think it's so powerful in the story, and really gives us a lot of clarity on what Clarice has been struggling with. Would you talk more about the revision process? Anything you feel like is worth mentioning, and also just anything about that scene in particular and sort of the process it went through?
Yeah, sure. As I said before, I was, you know, the piece started with me jotting ideas throughout the years. So it didn't really have a shape in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But at some point, I think when I was in my MFA, that I felt like, okay, maybe I want to workshop this piece. And then I started giving some kind of a shape to it. And then the first version was not actually 14 hours, but it was something like the last days of her life. So the timeline was different. The structure was different. And there was also room for me to develop some side characters like her sons. Yeah, there was a son that was coming to visit her in the hospital. So there was also like a scenes with her in her apartment, and then in the taxi, and then in her in the hospice. So yeah, the timeline was different, the structure was different, and it was longer. To be honest with you, I don't know at which point I decided that it would be maybe more impressionist and more impactful mm-hmm. if I compress the timeline in hours. So it would be a piece that covered just a few hours. And I focused in the, so the what was happening, the setting would be her in a cab going to the hospice. And throughout that ride, because the ride is delayed because of traffic and all that, throughout that ride, she then, again, you know, saying goodbye to the city, saying goodbye to her life, and the city stimulating her to have some thoughts. Then she would go back and think about some moments of her life, but anything kind of in a rush, because her life was rushing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the story took a different shape, and I decided to compress it in a few hours, and then I think I settled on that. So when I sent it to the comma, was already on that shape. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And as far as the TV scene, yeah, it was not there before. It was on the original version, and then I removed it, but then I realized that I think you asked me for some a little more background, and I realized that scene provided the background that was needed. It was based again on the real interview that she gave on TV, and if you watch it, it's really something, because she's definitely irritated, annoyed, not interested in the questions. She says during the interview she's in a very bad mood and very sad, and which only adds to the mythical, the mythology around her. Because imagine today if a writer is being interviewed on TV and he says, "Oh, I'm not in the mood today, or I'm tired, I don't want to talk about this." I think nobody would do that, right? We would say, "Oh, well, great, I have an opportunity for an interview." She didn't care. She lived in another domain. She didn't care about, I think, the feeling, again, me imagining, the feeling was that everything came so late, and that at that point she was really disappointed with the way life turned out to be, where even a TV interview came in her last moment. I mean, that interview was given, I believe, a couple of weeks before she actually died, and so the fact that she was tired, it was not just, it was for real. She was tired because she was dying. And those kind of things really, that irony, let's say, was also something that drove me throughout this piece. And somehow connects also to one of her novels, The Hour of the Star, where that irony of life is right there. So the main character, Maccabea, at the end of that novel, she goes to a fortune teller, and the fortune teller says, "You're gonna have a wonderful life." Well, just some background, the character is a poor woman from Northeast Brazil living in Rio, and the fortune teller tells her, "You're gonna have a great life. You're actually gonna meet a tall, blonde foreigner," and stuff like that. And when Maccabea leaves the fortune teller, she's hit by a Mercedes, driven by a tall, blonde foreigner, and then she dies right there on the spot.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that irony there I transposed to the story, because at some point in my story, Clarice also goes to a fortune teller who tells her all those wonderful things.
Right.
57 is your year. You're going to be successful. You're going to achieve all this. You're going to transform yourself. And so she was getting all these signs that life was going to be amazing from now on. But then, irony, she actually got sick. And yeah, so I think I'm responding to your answering your question with your a lot of deviations here.
No. I mean, you're thinking about all the things I'm thinking about because, you know, I think it's tricky because, like, you know, you're a writer, I'm a writer, and an editor. Like, part of that life is imagining success for yourself and imagining people reading your work and responding to it and liking it a lot, and maybe a lot of people reading it. And so there, I think there's like an almost an element of horror in the idea of like having that, but it coming too late. And I mean, like, who wouldn't be disappointed? Who wouldn't be a little like bitter in an interview when you finally get your big, your big fame or your big success, and you're sort of over it by that point? You know, that's,
it's important to point out that she was never really famous, right? So we're talking about small fame here. She was famous and recognized within the literary circles, but she was never a popular writer. And that's why I said before that I was surprised myself when I saw her success in the US. I never thought that that would happen because my relationship with her writing was very personal. You know, it was like I was taking... It's almost like you find something so special and then you keep it to yourself. You don't even talk about it with other people. And then suddenly all this happened. And again, another irony of her legacy is that all this is happening 40 years after she died.
Yeah.
So that sense of irony of life was definitely in my mind when I was writing this.
Yeah, I also really feel like I agree with you that like the last 10 years, like the last few years have, you know, just this rise in recognition for her work. And so, you know, reading your piece is almost like another irony where I feel like I read it around the same time that I was really just starting to see her name everywhere, you know, to see her on these lists and things. So the Common publishes a lot of work in translation. And so I've talked with quite a few translators on the podcast, but I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about being a translator and a fiction writer, both. Like, are there aspects of one that influences the other? Are there skills from one that help you do the other thing better?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, as you know, English is my second language. So, for me, to be translating into English or even writing my own material in English, the two things are very interrelated because I am a writer that works at the sentence level. I look at each sentence as a world in itself. And when you do that, and you definitely do that in translation, right? So translation, you take one sentence in the original and you work on the sentence. What is the best version of this sentence on the target language? And again, for me, because I'm approaching the target language, English, from a non-native perspective, that work is different, I'm assuming, than a native English speaker and translator or writer, because maybe the sentence is not loaded with meaning like it might be for you, for example. But it makes me analyze the sentence in a different light. And almost kind of a trying to strip the sentence to the bone, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I think, for example, when I write in Portuguese, my native language, I can get caught in the allegories of language and get carried away. And when I am writing in English, I really try to strip the language to the bone, like remove the excesses. Especially Portuguese is a language that allows so much playfulness. It's not that the English doesn't do, but in my mind, English is a more straightforward, objective, structured syntax. That's not so much the case with Portuguese. So I guess answering your question, the translator, especially because I've translated an author that is very challenging when it comes to syntax, the translator made me definitely a better writer at the sentence level and made me think about all the moves that I make in my own writing.
That's really interesting. I think you're totally right. Me, who doesn't speak any other languages very well. I do think you're right that English is sort of a, I don't know, there's something about it that's a little stiff, especially when I think about all the rules for constructing a sentence in English and what can go where and that kind of thing. And certainly other translators on the show, on the podcast, translating from Arabic have mentioned the same thing, which is that other languages can have a little more space for sort of, yeah, flourish or figurative language, I guess I would say, yeah. That's great. Would you talk a little bit about the challenges of translating fiction from Portuguese into English specifically? Like, are there certain things you have to look out for?
Yeah, I think it has to do with what we were saying before. I think mm-hmm. Portuguese, it's a much more, I don't want to say flourished, but I think more, well, first of all, it's a very old language. And even the Brazilian Portuguese is very different than the Portuguese from Portugal. Mm-hmm. And in Brazil, we have incorporated a lot of indigenous expressions and expressions from African Brazilian descendants. Mm-hmm. So the Brazilian Portuguese is much more impure than the Portuguese from Portugal. And then, and all that playfulness of Portuguese can be challenging sometimes transposing to English. Especially the author that I translate mostly, João Gilberto Noll, he's similar to Clarice Lispector in the way of being very playful with the language and defying also the rules of grammar and syntax in Portuguese. So that's a challenge in itself, because besides the language being challenging to transpose into English, you also have these particularities of this particular author that makes it even more challenging. And in the case of Noll, he's from the southern region of Brazil, the same region that I am from. And he uses a lot of regional expressions that people, for example, in São Paulo, Rio, would not understand or would need some kind of a regional dictionary. For me, the connection with his particular Portuguese was very strong because I could relate to that regional level. And there were words that my mom used to use, for example, that I don't use, but I could relate to that. So the Portuguese, the Brazilian Portuguese is very rich and with very layers of complexity based on your background in the region you're born or grow up. It is challenging, but it's fascinating. I'm very fascinated by this idea of transposing a language into another one, and especially the English language, which is, I guess I have some knowledge. So it's very interesting. That's what drove me to translation to begin with, that, oh my God, I can take this masterpiece and work at the word level, sentence level, and transform it into another language. That is fascinating for me.
Yeah, I think that is so interesting. I love the idea of that, like the richness and the different layers of Brazilian Portuguese. I haven't heard anyone say that before, but it makes perfect sense. And I do think that the most fun part of translating to me seems like that, just working at the sentence level. Like, for once, you don't have to worry about plot and arc and structure and all these other things, because those things are done for you already. You can just, you know, play with the language, which is, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, the best part of writing.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that, but you still have to understand it, right?
Oh, for sure.
In the case of Noll and Clarice Lispector, they work with so much abstractions. You also have to do that work of interpreting. What do they really mean by saying that? Or are there many interpretations for this sentence or for what is trying to be conveyed here? So all the work that you do as a writer when you are writing your own piece, that mystery of language, that decodification that you have to do, is still there as a translator or a writer.
For sure. Yeah. You'd have to like understand it. I also would think, you know, in so much writing, there's so much subtext, and I think it comes from like word choice and language choice. And
exactly.
Yeah. And like that subtext also comes from, yeah, your general understanding of what the book is about or trying to say. Yeah. So I know that English is not your first language. So I'm wondering, how do you approach writing and translating in your second language?
Yeah. I made this choice of translating into English because I live in the US for 20 years and my reality is here and I am immersed in this language and culture 24 hours a day.
Right.
I think in English, I dream in English, I write in English all day. For me, it came natural. And I was not interested in translating English or American literature into Portuguese. That's been done to exhaustion. Unfortunately, well, it's not unfortunate, but it's just a fact that, you know, I guess 50% of what is published in Brazil is translation. That's not the reality here. It's the opposite, right?
No,
so only 3% of what is published is translation. So I was interested, a project perspective, I was interested in promoting Brazilian literature in the U.S., first, and then second, for the reason that I just gave in terms of being immersed here, it felt natural to me. Of course, it's not my native language, so there are some limitations, and for that, I need good editors such as yourself. One thing that I have learned for sure in the last few years writing in English is that the importance of an editor. Somebody who has a different pair of eyes and somebody who can see the bigger picture. And I have had the luck to being working with great publishers, editors. Mm-hmm. At Two Lines Press, the publisher that publishes João Gilberto Noel, C.G. Evans, it's a great editor and he knows exactly what I'm trying to say and then he suggests a better rendition. You just have to surround yourself with good friends.
Absolutely.
When you're writing in your second language,
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I know a lot of translation work can be really, you know, like you said, it's like solo work. You're mostly doing it by yourself. But that moment where you can get some fresh eyes in it and have someone, you know, help you get the word choice right or get the angle right is. You know, essential. Yeah.
I'm constantly asking friends, how do you say this? And what's the best word to say that? And
I think that also those of us writing in English as our first language also ask our friends that question. And I think, language is endless and we will all be working forever to get it right and to get those feelings and nuances right. Yeah.
Yeah. There's when you know a language, you can know in many different levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is my level of English, let's say. And also, the same way that I speak with an accent, I don't mind that my writing has some kind of accent because this is it. I mean, English has become this global language or lingua franca. So what is, who can really say, okay, this is perfect English or the proper English when you have so many different cultures and ethnicities and backgrounds appropriating from this language. So it has become, a language for everyone to use and, I'm using it the best way I can.
But I love that. And I love that, you know, you're not necessarily trying to use it exactly the way people might think you should be, you know, like I think there's an element of style in retaining the parts of, you know, your original language that you want to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you talked about the two novels you translated by João Gilberto Noel for Two Lines Press. We love Two Lines Press. And I know you're working on a third one now. What is it about his work that appeals to you specifically?
It's interesting because my piece, the piece we were discussing earlier, it's about Clarice Lispector. And I would say Clarice Lispector and João Gilberto Noel are probably my two favorite writers, at least when it comes to Portuguese literature. And in my mind, when I, let's say, yeah, like 10 years ago, when I started thinking about translating into English, those are the two authors that came to my mind, always. Mm-hmm. Just because I, you know, I'm fascinated by their work. But then, yeah, so it, then the works by Clarice Lispector started getting translated and published in the US. And I was like, okay, that was not an option anymore. And then I went to my second, it was not second, but the other option right. I had. And yeah, so I was doing my MFA in creative writing, and I was taking classes in literary translation, and a project for one class became a book proposal that went to Two Lines Press, and the rest is history, let's say. They really liked it, and they are publishing, yeah, my third translation, and I'm very happy to see Noel's work getting published in the U.S. It's something that talks to me in a very personal level, and then to be able to offer that to a wider audience, it's really rewarding. It's really something. And right now I'm actually translating a novel that an excerpt is coming up on an anthology by Two Lines Press called Calico. It's a great anthology published twice a year with a very global approach and scope. So you're getting an excerpt there, and it's coming out in the fall. And then the full book length is coming out next fall in 2022. And it's called Hugs and Cuddles, and is my favorite Noel's book. The most challenging as well, grammatically, syntactically, and even thematically. Yeah, so that's the project that I'm working on now, and that should take my time for the rest of the year.
That's great. We'll definitely link to those books in the podcast notes, because they sound fascinating. And I'm wondering, just a little follow-up question, when you talked about the syntax that Noel uses being kind of complex or unusual, so when you're translating, are you trying to convey that oddity or like unusual syntax to English readers, or is that kind of untranslatable?
No, I try some, let's say some adaptation to American English more in particular, right? Because it's I'm not trying a British or Australian English. What sounds right in American English within an America culture context? But I do also preserve some of the foreignness, because I think, first of all, the readership of translation is so small in the country. And I think somebody reading a work like Noel's understands that this is a translation and expects some kind of something weird anyway. How many times we hear that about Clarice Lispector, that syntax is weird and the strange and all those words. So I'm not concerned about if it sounds weird, but I do try my best to transpose into an American, let's say, I try to make it not easier to an American audience, but try to make it more digestible or more, I guess, easier. Yeah, easier could be the word.
Mm-hmm. Like it needs to be accessible, but it doesn't necessarily need to be like easy and breezy. Yeah,
accessible is the word that I was looking for. Oh, so okay, not great. Easy, but more accessible. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's always a sort of a balancing act as a translator. So somehow between all of this translating you've been doing, you have also found time to complete a novel. And it's in both Portuguese and English. Would you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so it's a novel that I started doing my MFA program. And Yeah, it's a novel. It's a historical novel that it happens in Brazil. It's about Italian immigrants arriving in Brazil 100 years ago. It's loosely based on the story of my own family. As you can see from my last name, is Italian, and there were a lot of Italian immigration in southern Brazil. So it's loosely based on that. But again, I was interested more in how those people saw the world. Then it's much more driven by characters' impression of this new world, right? If you think of Brazil of 100, south of Brazil 100 years ago, you're talking about forests and mountains and rivers and a very wild world. So that's how that's what guided me through this novel. And I started writing in English because of my MFA program. And then at some point, because it was such a Brazilian story too, I decided to experiment with Portuguese, which I had abandoned for a while. I was not writing Portuguese for a long time. And I decided to do that switch. Then I found all sets of challenges. I didn't realize how my mind was so entrenched in the English language. So for me, writing that novel was also a way to recover my own native language and my own roots. So at the end of the day, I finished that novel in Portuguese, and now I am translating myself, let's say, into English. Yeah, it's an interesting process. It started in English, I finished in Portuguese, and now I want to continue the English version.
That is so interesting. Yeah, when I saw that it was in both Portuguese and English, I was like, I have questions about what that means. I didn't know if it was sort of a combination of both or if it was both novels.
What is challenging is that when you translate somebody else, you cannot change the original, right? But when I'm translating myself, I start making these changes. So it can become daunting. Like for sometimes, sure. Yeah, there's no end in sight because you just keep changing.
Yeah, I feel that a lot right now. I'm revising a novel, and it seems like you could just do it for years and still never be done.
Yes, that's the feeling I'm having right now.
So always the last question we ask podcast guests is what you're working on now, what we should look for next. Do you feel like we've already covered that, or is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, right now I started translating Hugs and Cuddles, and that project is going to last my entire year.
Wow.
It's going to take my entire year. Yeah, it's a very complex, difficult novel. And that kind of explains why also my own writing gets a little pushed aside, right? Because I just could not refuse the invitation of translating another novel, a non-novel. I cannot say no. So then I say, okay, I'll put this my own project on the side for now and and just being grateful for the opportunity to translate now.
That's great. You know, I'm thinking about how great it is that, you know, we talked earlier about how this short story is a way to kind of commune with Clarice Lispector. And I feel like in translating Noel as well, you've basically been able to, through writing, commune with, you know, your two favorite writers. That is just, that's magic. I'm so happy that you were able to do that.
Yes. It's really fascinating because as a writer, you know how that's all we want, right? Create that connection with our idols and hopefully our readers are going to connect with us at that level too. And with Clarice and Noel, my relationship with them is it's so personal, but at the same time, it's also is shared by so many readers, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like every reader has that personal relationship with those authors. And I just, again, have the privilege to then be able to be really, really, really close to their minds. Great.
I mean, that sounds like the dream. Edgar Garvalato, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so great to talk with you.
Thank you, Emily, for having me. And good luck for all this year.
Thank you. We need it. Listeners, you can read Edgar's story, A 14-Hour Lesson in Theosophy, and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.